always in the leadoff spot in the 5 o'clock hour. Writer Colin Fleming joins us. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, sir?
Well, it's a brand new month. It's already November-like weather up here in eastern Maine. I don't know what you're getting in the Boston area, but we've skipped all of the transitional kind of weather and just moved right on to November.
Yeah, no interregnum phase for the weather this year here either. It's light jacket weather for a lot of people. So it's kicked in nice and fall-like.
Well, and perfect weather, I would think, to do what you did, and that is revisit a book that I loved as a high schooler, Myron Cope's The Game That Was.
It is an excellent book. It is perhaps the best football book. It is an answer, the football answer to The Glory of Their Times, which was an oral history, a baseball book that came out in the late 1960s, and this book comes out in 1970. And it's going around Myron Cope, who was a writer for Sports Illustrated, and talking to a lot of the original NFL guys. We have the 100th anniversary of the NFL this year. While they were, they were out working their jobs because they had to live, just like they often had jobs during the regular season, because the NFL, the professional league, was a bum league when it started. College was where it was at.
Right.
College was what everybody cared about. So it's like a reverse of what you get in Boston right now, where college sports are non-existent. It's such a pro city in terms of its sporting interest. But at the time, back then, Boston actually had a team before the Redskins went to Washington. They were in Boston. But college was huge, and you had this renegade league of these guys who would fudge their names so they wouldn't lose college eligibility, and it was this startup rabble kind of a league that produced a number of colorful characters, colorful stories, certainly.
And I think one of my favorites from the book, because I didn't know much about him until I read it, but the story of Bobby Lane, who remains one of my favorite players of all time.
The stories are great. When you get to Lane, it's getting a little more modern, right?
Right.
Like, okay, this is permissible. This isn't against, like, the laws of nature. But early on, when it's the rough and tumble Wild West of the league, I love those stories. Like, it starts off with this guy named Ed Healy, and he's playing against George Halas, the poncho for the Bears, who was a player. And he's being held a lot because these guys at the time, don't forget, they went both ways. They didn't have what they eventually called the platoon system. And so this guy, I've been saying this line all day, he says to the referee, he said, "Roy, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. In the event that House holds me again, I am going to commit mayhem." So like a few lines later, it continues with his story, and he's still saying this line about how he is going to commit this mayhem. Now, bear in mind, please, that we had a squad of about 15 or 16 men. Neither Duke Slater, our right tackle, nor I had a substitute on the bench. So I said, "Roy, you can't put me out of the game because we don't have another tackle, and I can't really afford to be put out of this ball game because of your failure to call Halas's holding. I have notified him, and I'm about to commit mayhem."
I love that.
It reminds me of that line, and people used to just be so much more intelligent, I think. I really think we're much stupider now, and there's this, when Melville, he had this inspiration of this real ship that was knocked clean into the sea by a whale. And that was a real ship that went out from Nantucket. And there was a guy named Owen Chase who was a seaman on this ship. And the captain rows back from his Nantucket sleigh ride because they've all been out chasing the whales. And he gets to where the ship should be. And the ship's not there. And he turns to Seaman Chase and he says, "What ails the ship?" And it's just that understated way of speaking that you see throughout this book and the colorful phrase making. But then there is somebody whose mere mention of his name, I'm sure, is going to delight you and your reminiscences. And that is one Johnny Blood, who is the ultimate football character.
Absolutely. Yeah. God. But, and you know, I love the fact that those guys had to work for a living, often in another job, and yes, in the off season, sometimes even during the season, they would be working part time. And it was a simpler game then.
Often, right. And they're playing the 60 minutes, so they're in worse shape than players are now. They didn't have face masks, but they would get $100 a game, $175 a game. Johnny Blood, he was this college star in these, and he was a ladies' man. He was a ladies' man who would read Chaucer and Shakespeare, except when he got drunk, and then he would read dime novels. And these three or four women come up to him, like college co-eds, and they have a program. And they're like, can you sign our Rose Bowl program? He takes a knife and he cuts his hand, his arm open, and he signs it in blood because he's Johnny Blood. And he had this great line, too, when he's describing himself to Myron Cope. It's one of my favorite lines in all of literature. He says, I was always full of run. And it's like off kilter. It's not really how grammar works syntactically, but you absolutely get the meaning. And he comes up throughout this book. Other guys, when Cope goes to their house, they're talking about Blood. Like this one guy is saying, oh, you wouldn't believe what Blood used to do. I'm thinking like, yeah, I'm pretty well prepared for this, but go ahead. So he would go into town and he would rent out the whorehouse. Well, you're probably not allowed to say whorehouse anymore. He would rent out the place where the adult entertainers lived. And the guy's like, oh, I think he just wanted to show that he could do it. He wasn't in there actually doing anything. He's like, he's Johnny Blood, dude. Of course he's in there. He's doing everything.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Sean McAdams coming up a little later to offer his thoughts on the Red Sox season. But I want yours. What happened? What went wrong this year?
Institutional hubris, mainly starting with Alex Cora. The way he was talking, I think that last year, I think they were lucky. I do not think that was an all-time great team. I do not think it was an all-time great Red Sox team. I think it's a team that got out ahead of it early. And based off of how they played in previous recent postseasons, they were a team for whom it behooved them to run from in front like that. And I don't put a lot of stock whatsoever in the number of wins that they had last year, because I don't even think for the regular season that their regular season was the most impressive regular season in last year's baseball campaign. And somebody could say, like, how could you make that remark? I think it's a lot harder to win 103 games as a team that repeats, like the Astros did, than for the Red Sox to have won 108 last year. And the Astros won 107 this year. The Yankees won 100 both years. So what does that really mean, whether you win 108, you win 101, whatever the number is? And then in the playoffs, they won, I felt like, despite their best players. They won because of people like Nathan Eovaldi and Steve Pearce and Brock Holt. They didn't win because of Mookie Betts and guys like J.D. Martinez was consistent. And it easily could have turned on them in the Astros series. I don't know. People tend to forget that in that Dodgers series, they have the Eovaldi game in Game 3. And they're up against it in Game 4. They are down late big in that game. And they come back. If they don't come back in those last few innings of that game, I don't know that they win that World Series. So everything the Cora did, which was just over-aggressive in my thinking, more aggressive than even a Grady Little was bringing back Martinez that year in 03. And it worked out. And I think he came in riding that hubris horse. We can just show up and it's going to go this way. And they were never right. For all of the stats and the stat padding, there was an internal insouciance with this team that I found borderline offensive. The show up and it's going to be awesome attitude. You thought last year was great. Wait until you see what we do this year. Like, dude, people are coming for you this year. They want to eat you alive. And you have this laissez-faire attitude. And when that snowballs on you, you never get out of the ball of snow. And they didn't.
No, and that started in spring training when they decided to hold back their starting pitchers to save them for when they really needed them. And they never got it together.
Baseball is not a flip-the-switch sport. Baseball is a grinded every single day kind of sport, just like you grind every single count when you're up there, those great Red Sox teams. And they just had that, eventually we'll get there. And it's like, it's not going to work. They didn't play crisp baseball. And Mookie Betts is going to win a gold glove, but I watched enough games this year to think he let that ball bounce and become a double near the foul pole. He would have had that last year. There is something off with this team. If you're around squirts in hockey, you coach squirts in hockey, you can tell when there is something just not right. It's not clicking. And you can have everybody in baseball get 100 RBI and everybody have an OPS over 900. and you can jump through hoops to try to get a guy 20 wins. And look at all of those stats. Those stats are just RBI baseball Nintendo stats, right? But what did it all add up to? There was always something wrong with this team. And a lot of those guys, or at least in terms with Betts, that's why I have mixed feelings on what's going to happen to him. Because he's an amazing talent. But, man, did he fill up that stat sheet once they were out of it. And I think he's just that kind of guy. He got off to an amazing start in 2018. They all did. They're 17-2, and I think they're the team that needs to be in that position to thrive. I don't think that they come from behind as well as a team like the Astros, which seems much more seasoned to me. They just are a team I would not want to tangle with, whereas the Red Sox, it's not going so great. Lean on them, and they're going to fold.
Let's shift gears and celebrate the 200th anniversary of one of the great works, I think, of American literature, Washington Irving's story of Rip Van Winkle, 200 years ago.
Great works, but a highly, I don't want to say plagiarized work, but let's say a largely borrowed work, because there has been a version of this story in many cultures. It's in the Bible. It's in German folklore. You do not have to go far to find it in ancient Greece. It's always been around, this idea of somebody who catnapped too long. What I think Washington Irving made it work so well with was the New England setting, that Northeast setting, where you really, it plays well in fall, right, in the Northeast corridor. It definitely does. And the idea of that, yeah, you could go back into these woods. Who knows what's going on in these woods? You hunt, and there are all these legends and all that going on out there. Don't forget he's doing Legend of Sleepy Hollow and everything, too, in the same book, although that story would come out next year. So you have this idea of these people playing, they're really bowling in the woods is what's happening. And that informs the sound of the thunder and everything, and this guy falls asleep. But he's Washington Irving. He wrote this story because he didn't like how life was going. He thought, you know what, maybe I can make some coin by doing some of this fiction stuff. So he puts in these humorous notes. Like, the guy gets up, and he's like, oh, no, my gun's rusted, my beard's really long, where's my faithful dog? And he goes into town, and he learns that his wife is dead. He's like, oh, it's okay. he's like, oh, all right, cool. So pros and cons, he's doing like this accounting of everything that's happened to him, and he just wants to drink in the woods. And it turns out that now he can live a shiftless, indolent life because he's old enough. He slept through the working years. I think a lot of the slack-assed, lazy people in our culture would love to wake up and be like, mean it? I can just go to a parking lot and listen to atrocious modern country music and drink, and it's cool? You're like, yeah. So that's what he has going on for him.
And finally, let's talk about Rousseau's Reveries of a Solitary Walker. Did Rousseau know that you would come along and be the perfect person to read this book?
Yeah, in some ways, I hope I'm not the perfect person to read this book, because what Rousseau, and he dies while he's writing this book, so I'd like to avoid something like that.
Yes.
But he says that I'm going to take these walks. And while I take these walks, I'm going to describe to you everything that I'm thinking, because I've gotten into a place in my life where my enemies have so totally destroyed me that they've actually made a mistake in the perfection of their destruction. They have taken every last vestige of hope from my life. So now I can just walk around and think whatever, because I know it is impossible for my life to get worse, and I will never know the likes of hope again. Now, I feel that way, too, as the most hated person in his industry who's blackballed throughout it. But I tried to manufacture my own hope, not a false hope, but a ray that can eventually become a full-on mighty nuclear sun in the heavens. But Rousseau's walking around, and he's fretting, too, that he's lost some of his fastball, really, off of his creativity. And he's saying, I'm having these epiphanies now in life as I walk around on these long jaunts. And he tortures some people while he's out there. He's like, oh, I hate this woman. She wants me to write a preface for a rubbish book. He doesn't really hold back. And he's worried that he's come too late to these epiphanies that he's discovering through walking, because I posted on Twitter recently that I feel the world would be a better place if people listened to things like Beethoven's string quartets, the late string quartets. And I ran out of characters. And what I would have added otherwise was that I think we'd all be a lot better as people and a lot nicer to each other if we walked more. I don't mean that you have to go off on a 20-mile walk like I did on Saturday, but there's something about walking, and Rousseau ties into it very early on in these essays, that you cannot escape the truth when you walk. It's not going to be a possibility for you. It is going to help you, or help you help yourself, or it might destroy you. And I would say that's kind of a survival of the fittest thing if you can't handle truth and truth about yourself. But he's describing that process in real time as it unfolds. Like, wow, I didn't know when you walk around that you become aware of these things that I didn't know in the rest of my life. And each essay is structured as a walk. So he dies during walk number 10. But you get 10 full walks with this guy, and each one is written in a different style. You take different walks to different places. You go at different paces. They have different levels of musicality. And it's about that learning process that inevitably comes, for good or for bad, when we walk.
That's why I always feel a little badly for people who I see walking with earbuds in, listening to music or podcasts or something, because I think they're missing out on the best part of walking.
I guess it depends, too, on the person, on how adept you are at, like, for instance, when I'm talking to you all the time, I'm always doing other things. I'm writing things, I'm pitching things, I'm reading things, I'm making notes, but I don't think people can tell that because I'm able to do a lot of different things at once. So, sure, there could be people who walk around and they listen to Franz Liszt or whatever, and they're thinking about this conversation they had with some late family member and how they could have handled it better, and now that same behavior is bleeding into the way they conduct themselves with their spouse, and that's maybe why their marriage is strained. Like, who knows? But I think most people do tend to lock in on, if they're chewing gum, they can pretty much only focus on chewing gum, sadly. It's a skill. It's something you practice or you just become more accustomed to. But people will try to do anything, I've seen, to not have to be alone with their thoughts. Mm-hmm. Now, the good thing about walking and being alone with your thoughts is you have physical release and relief. When you're just sitting in bed, that can be really difficult.
Right.
People get up and they have the glass of vodka or whatever. When you're walking, you're subtly burning off the stress as you go. Like today I didn't climb, for instance, and I feel even worse than I usually do when I'm perpetually in hang on mode as it is. And I can feel that just after one day as somebody who has a surfeit of self-awareness. So I always think the same thing, but I also wonder if those people were stripped of those earbuds and those podcasts, would they be able to take that 25-minute walk? And I think they might be calling the Uber, which is part of the reason why we're in the situation that we're in.
There you go. I appreciate the multitasking. I'm actually making a pie and building something with Legos while talking to you.
Well, I always assume that.
Colin Fleming, check out his work. Wonderful as we know it is at ColinFlemingLit.com. Thank you, my friend. We'll check in again next week.
Sounds good.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.